welcome to the latest edition of Talking Natural Capital, a podcast from Galbraith. I'm your host, Matt Finlay, and I'm delighted to be joined, as always, by Eleanor Harris.
Hello.
Eleanor, it's been a while. We've not seen each other since our Natural Capital breakfast at the Royal Highland Show, so it's nice to be back.
It is, and sadly it's raining here in Edinburgh now, but happy memories of sunshine at the show.
Yeah, it was a good week, and I'd urge the listeners to actually check out that interview that we did with Eleanor, just a little bit about what we get up to on a big show. I'm also joined by Alex Flynn, who heads up the Galbraith Forestry team in Inverness, and Rachel Ockert, who is also based in Inverness and leads on delivery of Galbraith's peatland restoration projects. Alex, you've been on before. Happy to be back.
Yeah, good. Thanks for inviting us back. It's good to be back.
And Rachel, first appearance for yourself, but welcome to Talking Natural Capital.
Thank you very much.
And we've also got a special external guest today, Lindsay Sivright. Lindsay, can you just tell us a little bit about what you do?
Hi. Well, thanks for inviting me along to speak today. I'm a deer management consultant, essentially. I'm self-employed and work with numerous people across the deer sector in various capacities, basically.
Excellent. Well, Eleanor, Lindsay's just touched on a little bit about what we're going to be talking about today. Can you just expand?
Yeah, I'm really excited to be talking about deer, one of the hottest topics in conservation and carbon and natural capital, certainly in Scotland, but very much in England and wider as well. When I started out in forestry working for Comfort, and I used to, almost everything I said, couldn't we do this? What about this? People would say, it's more complicated than that, and it involves deer. And once I started thinking I understood deer, people would say, oh, no, it's actually more complicated than that. So that's the main thing I know about deer. They're very tasty to eat. They're very nice to see when you're wandering about the countryside, but they're pretty complicated. So we've got three expert practitioners to discuss it. So I'm going to pitch in some questions and see what they all make of them. And the first thing that we often talk about, dear, is just numbers. And I'd like to explore a bit how deer numbers are changing and what you've seen, but what the statistics are telling us and why this matters. So Lindsay, start with you as our guest.
Thank you. This is always the burning question, isn't it? How many deer do we actually have? So in terms of deer numbers, looking at that specifically, what we do know is that certainly in the uplands, I think it's well documented that deer numbers were rising up until fairly recently. But I would say through a collaborative effort across the deer management groups, which essentially cover about 3 million hectares of the uplands, we know that at least deer numbers have at least stabilised or are in most cases decreasing across the uplands. And as I say, I think that's largely due to these collaborative structures that we've had in place. We know that because there's a concerted effort to count deer through a count programme that's implemented by Nature Scots. So we've got really good handle, good data on what deer numbers look like in the uplands. I think we were not so sure, and you're right, it is complicated, is in looking at deer numbers in other areas, so particularly in the lowlands and also thinking about deer in our expanding woodlands. Deer are extremely difficult to count in those scenarios, so we can only really come up with our best estimates on that. So I would say that the picture is changing, certainly as far as the Scottish Government's concerned. The Scottish Government's been very clear that we just need less deer, and we need less deer now. So that really is a very big focus across the sector at the moment.
Yeah, we should perhaps expand on what we mean by deer, because there's more than one sort. So what species of deer have we got in the UK? Do we find them?
So if we talk about Scotland, we've got two native species of deer. We've got the red deer, which are in the uplands, and we do get some roe deer in the uplands too, but roe deer predominantly found in the lowlands. So they are native species. Red deer, obviously the iconic one that everyone sees roaming around the hillsides. Roe deer are very much smaller, a bit more secretive. But we also have some pockets of fallow deer, And of course, we've got Sika deer throughout Scotland. And they were an introduced species, but they've done extremely well. And so there's this constant sort of tension between red deer and Sika deer. At one time, we were recognizing that they could interbreed. But now Sika are pretty established, but they fall in size somewhere between red deer and roe deer. But they're very secretive, so you hardly really see them at all.
Right, so there's different types, different deer, different places. We're going to come on to talk about people, because as with all natural capital, it's often not so much about the animal as about the people involved. But and to preliminary question, because they're going to be mentioned again, is what is a deer management group? We hear about these a lot. What do they do? How have they come about?
So essentially they came about, I think, in the late 60s. And it was really just a mechanism to try and get people around the table, recognising that within deer management there are potentially areas of conflict. So for some people's management objectives, they want fewer deer. Some people's management objectives may be around having a certain number of deer in the landscape. So there's always been that slight sort of tension and conflict and when we talk about deer management groups, we are talking about predominantly red deer, which obviously roam quite freely across numbers of land holdings. So the deer management groups were really developed on a voluntary basis to try and bring people around the table to try and reconcile where some of those conflicts may have arisen. And gradually over the years, they've expanded in number, and they've also expanded in membership as well. And so I guess traditionally, deer management groups might have been made up of sort of very traditional landowners coming together. Now we're seeing deer management groups having a much more varied membership. So whether it's community involvement, whether that's particularly where we have land being bought by, for example, ENGOs, we've now got much more sort of conservation, much more sort of diverse representation at those groups, if you like. So again, they're being used in the same way to try and reconcile and trying to sort of help people manage deer effectively across the landscape.
Yeah, so they've got a really important role, and it has to be done collaboratively, because deer don't really care where estates start and end. They go where they want to. And so that comes on to a question that I'd be interested to hear all three of you reflect on, is different groups in the countryside and what different attitudes to deer do they have? What are they thinking needs to be done? We've heard that the public sector, Scottish Government, is keen to reduce deer numbers, but what about other stakeholders, and our attitudes changing? Because it seems to me that that this isn't static, that the deer discourse is on the move. So all three of you would be interested to hear what you think about that.
Well, I suppose from my perspective, I've been working in this sector now for the last 20 years, and I suppose I have, in my day-to-day work, I have the opportunity to work at all different levels, whether that's working with government. I work with the Association of Deer Management Groups, so we've got quite a close relationship with government. We are in constant dialogue with government, so we try to keep a quite close handle on what the government's aspirations might be for deer, and we're working with them to manage that. But all the way down to, you know, I also do work on the ground with individual landowners and with deer management groups as well. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, I've seen a real groundswell change in attitudes towards deer over the last 20 years. And I think, you know, that's come about as we're developing a greater understanding of deer, not just deer, but also their impact on the environment. And then we have all of these other elements coming into play now, where I think crucially the uplands now, there's so much pressure on the uplands to deliver multiple benefits. And the spotlight has really come upon the uplands now in terms of all the things that you guys are interested in peatlands and woodlands and how we deliver all of that. So I think we've got much more awareness now about our uplands, about how we might utilise them, and obviously deer completely underpin all of that, and how we manage them is going to be absolutely crucial to delivering, whether it's biodiversity, climate change, all of that. So that sort of language, although we've known about climate change and biodiversity for a long time, it's only really, I would say, in the last 5 years that all of that's been ramped up considerably. But I'd be keen to hear what you guys think.
I think another thing is that more recently, there's more news articles coming out. So a lot of the, well, not a lot of the general public, but some general public kind of watched the movie Bambi maybe, and they saw kind of deer control as a bad thing. But then actually the more awareness now of how deer can, in some cases, negatively impact the uplands, and deer numbers need to be controlled. It's maybe more of a general acceptance that it needs to be done.
Yeah, that's interesting. It was perhaps when my generation were young, there was quite a lot of hostility to killing things, and that's maybe not so much the case with the younger generation now, that they're becoming more aware of environmental of management. You need to balance things in nature. Sorry, Alex, I interrupted you.
Yeah, I was going to say, I agree with what Rachel was saying there, that, you know, it's becoming more of an acceptable thing to have management of deer, especially numbers. And when it comes to a forestry point of view, you know, to establish either a woodland creation or new restock sites, we have to control the number of deer to a sustainable level that we can establish the crops. One way we do that is either removing the deer completely by fencing or ensuring that we have someone on site that can control deer population.
So, Alex, yeah, I was going to ask you about woodland. Sort about woodland. We're going to come onto peatland in a minute. But the challenges, Scotland's been creating a lot of woodland, but how do you navigate around the deer? You can plant species that they're not going to eat, or you can shoot them, or you can fence them out. Or you can perhaps plan a woodland differently with their constraints. What are the favoured ways of doing it?
So it all depends on what species you are planting. So, but, you know, up in the uplands, we do like planting a lot of native species, Scots pine, which fits really well into the landscape, which are all favourable food sources for deer as they're going across the landscape. So a good way of stopping any kind of browsing damage would be to fencing. That's one of our main ways of protecting against browsing. But some of your commercial crops, like Sitka spruce, they're less favourable because they're a lot more spiky. So we would just use maybe stalkers in that point. So, but mainly we'd fence, or we use tree shelters as well. But they get to a certain height, and the height of the tree shelter is a perfect height for a deer to just look straight into it and eat a nice tasty new bud.
Lindsay, is that your experience of managing deer for woodlands? What kind of roles have you played in helping trees get established or regenerate?
Yeah, so I guess one of my roles in this is we talk a lot about deer numbers, but actually what we're really talking about is deer densities and how deer utilise different areas of the landscape. And usually my job is to sort of come in and use all the available information to understand, you know, if we're wanting to plant trees in a particular area, you know, is that an area that's normally used by deer? Is that an area that we might have to fence? Is that an area that we could use deer control to simply get trees away? So I often think of my job as being a professional jigsaw puzzler. I try and bring all the bits of information to the table, and this comes from peatland as well. It's about understanding at what times of the year deer are utilising the landscape, and then thinking about, you know, even just using things like, it's really importantly, things like stalker's knowledge. You know, how are deer moving in that landscape? Where do they favour to be? And if it's just, if you have 100 deer across your estate, the overall deer number may be low and your overall density may be low, but if all those 100 deer want to be in your prime piece of new woodland, then, you know, that's something that we have to think about. So it's using all the information that we can to try and deliver these objectives, really. So it's quite a tricky job.
What sort of scale can you manage deer on? You can, if you've got a very small piece of woodland, presumably deer just walk in from around it. If you've got an estate, even a big landscape scale, you can create a kind of deer sink, can't you, where deer come in from neighbouring places. Does it really need to be done collaboratively through to deer management groups, or could it be done on a more local scale as well?
Yeah, I think it's about using all the tools in the toolbox, but you're absolutely right. I think part of the issue is trying not to think about what's happening in isolation. You have to look at that landscape scale view. And there is no question, nature abhors a vacuum. So if you're hitting deer really hard in one particular area, then you're creating clean ground for those deer, other deer, to move in. And I think this is part of the difficult conversation that we sometimes have in deer management groups, is that although people perhaps perceive this higher sort of deer control in one area as being an issue, it's getting people to understand that the solution to that lies with everybody. It's about that collective management of deer and having that discussion about, it's in everybody's interest, particularly for stags that might want to come onto lower ground, to keep stags out of areas that are just simply not wanted. And that might be, on woodland, it might be on lowland agricultural areas. So it's about finding those collective solutions. You're absolutely right.
What's the specific issue with stags? Isn't a deer just a deer?
Well, that's a good question. So traditionally, we have a whole element of deer management, which is that for many years, deer have been a resource. They're an important resource for many upland estates, and stags are commercially harvested throughout the year. And I guess traditionally we've looked at that as a very traditional way of using the uplands. But obviously now that way of utilising the uplands is now competing with all of these different other elements which are coming to the fore when we're starting to look at peatland restoration, we're starting to look at woodland expansion. All of those, are becoming more and more important. So it's about balancing all of those things. We've got to think about how we're using our uplands and optimising our use of our uplands, recognising that for many people deer are a benefit and continue to be a benefit. So how do we manage numbers in such a way that we can have our cake and eat it, essentially? That's the real challenge that we've got at the moment.
I think we'll come back to the sport and the kind of culture around this, because I think this is really important to Rachel. What about peatland? Peatland restoration is becoming also a huge policy priority for Scottish Government, because it's got such big carbon implications, but there aren't any trees to eat. So what's the issue with deer in peatland restoration?
There isn't as many solutions as forestry. It's quite a new thing. So obviously forestry's been around for a long time. People know the effect that deer have quite well on forestry. Whereas with peatland, because it's relatively new and it's up and coming, the exact effects that deer have on peatland restoration post-restoration is currently unknown or not well known. So it's kind of managing that. So like Lindsay was saying, it's kind of knowing, using what we already know. So it's, if there's a peatland restoration site in an area where deer winter and they'll be there all winter and there's short growing, there's no growth, that's where damage could be caused by deer. So it's avoiding doing peatland restoration in that area and kind of doing peatland restoration in other areas that maybe deer just pass through during the summer. And yeah, it just kind of depends where deer move is definitely one that we need to be aware of in peatland restoration.
So is it quantity of deer that are the issue, that they're eroding the peatland by walking about on it, essentially?
Yeah, so I think, as Lindsay said, deer densities, some areas on different estates will be able to take higher deer densities than others. You just kind of have to look at it at the estate as a whole and kind of look at these areas, and if they feed the deer during the winter, that could cause damage in those areas. So it's avoiding those areas and kind of picking the places that are least likely to be damaged and less susceptible to deer damage, mm-hmm. basically. And then you look at deer densities as well, and as the deer management group decide what they want to do in that area with deer densities, you can look at that as well. And yeah, the gamekeepers and the stalkers in on these estates are vital because they know the way the deer move, they know where they winter, they know where they summer, they know where the hinds and calves and stags are throughout the year, and that sort of information is just absolutely vital for these peatland restoration projects moving forward.
Right, yeah, so it's quite it's not just a case of we're going to design this project on a map and implement it and stick it on the ground. It's very much the project itself is led by the ecology and by the nature that's already there, which and the existing expertise of people on the ground, the stalkers and the people who've been working with the deer is crucial. So it's quite as with many of these natural capital projects, whether it's peatland restoration or agroforestry or other things, it's all brand new, and every project is an experiment and is learning, and we have to be quite open and humble, don't we, in working out what we can do.
I think one of the key things in all of this is understanding that deer are a part of the natural ecosystem. They're vital for our ecosystem. But and they will have an impact on the environment in which they live. So they browse, their hooves will leave hoof prints. So they will have an impact, and that's a natural process. The key is understanding at what point those impacts begin to become negative, and being able to look at the signs and read the signs and understand at what point, as I say, those impacts are becoming negative and might be impacting on your objectives. And I think we use those words almost interchangeably, but it's understanding the difference at what point impacts become damage, and that's absolutely key. And that's why it's about finding that really fine balance of not wanting to exclude deer completely from the environment. That's not in anyone's interest. It's finding that sweet spot where you can deliver all the objectives that you need, plus having deer as a natural part of that ecosystem.
Is keeping sport and stalking estates as part of the rural culture, is that actually quite important for being able to understand what's going on and being able to manage the landscape, or are they something that's will they go out of fashion? Will people stop engaging with the natural world in that way? I suppose I'm a bit conflicted because I don't stalk myself, but all I do in the landscape is kind of walk through it, and I've got quite a lot of respect for people that it seems a much closer relationship with nature to be stalking and encountering these animals and understanding them in this detail.
From what you were saying there, though, Eleanor, you know, you're coming in to do walk through the landscape. These estates have managed the deer on these estates, and the stags, what's came such a vital part of the Highland tourists, you know, people want to come to see these stags, you know, that they're only there because of the estates in the first place that wanted to breed these stags and for stalking. So I think it's all interlinked, and it like Lindsay said as well, they are part of the local biodiversity, and even in forests, you know, we do need them in forests as well. As Lindsay said about the hoof prints, well, it's a great way for natural regeneration. We need that break of the soil on some of these sites, so deer number is density is absolutely crucial when you're looking at forestry conservation. So it's also interlinked.
I think the culture element is a really important one to always think about in these conversations, because as I say, we have these fragile rural communities, and for a number of years, you know, that has been a real mainstay of those communities and bringing in income, in supporting employment, in supporting deer managers. And I think at the moment, all that we're hearing from government is that we need less deer and we need less deer now. And for all sorts of reasons, that's important. But I think what we have to do, for some, that will be seen as a very sort of negative. That's a challenge. And I think change, the prospect of change always brings about uncertainty and fear. So I think for many within the deer sector at the moment, they're seeing this language coming from the Scottish Government. We know the emphasis on biodiversity, carbon, all of these things, but it's how we manage that process of change. And some people are seeing that as a very negative thing. Oh, well, we'll have less deer to shoot, and that might affect our employment, and et cetera, et cetera. And I get that, and we've got to have empathy for that sort of perception. But I think there's also us looking at this as an opportunity. So that's one of the things we're trying to do at ADMG at the moment, is say, how do we take all the really good bits about deer stalking and the cultural aspects and the uplands and, you know, particularly the use of ponies, the tweed, all of those elements, which is such an amazing story to tell. How do we see the opportunity in that, and how do we do more with less of what we have? So if we're going to have less deer in the landscape, how do we utilize them in a much more productive way? You know, can we be creating better experiences of stalking and charging clients more for that experience? I have friends who come here from the States, and they are amazed at, they just love coming here because it's such a unique opportunity. And, you know, they have had the chance to go out with the stalkers who are incredibly knowledgeable and tell those amazing stories. It's like, how do we make that experience something that we can be really proud about, really shout about, and also be able to do more with that, whilst still being able to deliver all these other things that are really important and that are going to require us to manage deer much more effectively in the future. So I think, as I say, seeing the opportunities in here, and then thinking about, well, if we're going to start restoring habitats and we're going to see the health of the land recovering, that in turn is going to lead to much healthier deer. And the deer populations, although there may be a period of time where deer numbers come down, in my experience, deer numbers will bounce back and have the capacity to bounce back really quickly. So we could end up seeing more deer in the landscape that are actually harder to manage, given that we've got more woodlands, given that we might have more sort of, or better quality habitats. So paradoxically, deer management is only going to become more important in the future, not less. And that's about us taking, I'd say, those cultural elements, but actually bringing them into a sort of a new sphere of deer management, where we have to be really, really effective, but not losing sight of some of those traditional things that we want to retain as well. So I see a lot of opportunity, and it would be good, I think, for us, and obviously we're working with the sector to try and identify where those opportunities might be.
You touched on something that I think is really important that maybe people don't often consider, is that rising deer numbers isn't a sort of deer takeover. It's not good for the deer, is it? It's the individual deer's welfare is probably better if their numbers are lower and they're not fighting for resources in the way that they maybe are at the moment. And I remember, was it in the when the Beast from the East came along, I remember hearing foresters saying they kept finding dead deer in the woods all over the place because there was not enough food to go around. So it is also about the welfare of the deer, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I think that's a challenge, isn't it? Is it's not just about the health of the land, it's about the health of the deer. And if you've got healthy landscape, healthy ecosystems, you're going to have healthy deer. And again, that's what we're trying to think about, is that can we do more with less? So you might have fewer deer in the landscape, but they'll be more productive, producing better quality deer. If you're interested in deer stalking, you're going to produce better quality stags. So ultimately, I think we've got to start looking at future of deer management in those terms. And absolutely, deer welfare is absolutely paramount in all of this. We've got to make sure that we're securing that welfare, particularly where we might see in areas we know that deer numbers are going to have to be reduced. So that's obviously a key consideration in reducing numbers as well.
What I also heard there, Lindsay, is that, you know, estates for job security for stalkers is still going to, we are still going to need estates to have stalkers moving forward, even with this big push for restoring the landscape.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that. As I say, I am convinced that deer management is only going to become more important, not less. It might change subtly in terms of the way that we're doing it. And in cases, we're going to have to bring all the tools into the toolbox to be able to manage deer effectively. But I don't see any reason that we can't have it all, that we can have and retain all the really culturally good bits about deer management, while still keeping deer numbers at appropriate level for the habitat they're in. I really believe we can do that.
So what role is technology development changing playing in developing deer management? It's because the traditional spending a long time in the woods with a gun and a dog is still vital, but I hear a lot about technological innovation, and it's a fast developing field. Is that something that you're using, excited about?
Really excited about, yeah. So I think there's different areas where technology is really coming into play. So the use of satellites obviously allows us to be able to look at habitats in more detail. Understanding where different habitats are and the condition they're in is absolutely vital to understanding, you know, what the challenges are ahead, but also particularly how deer might utilise that landscape. So the use of satellite technology is amazing. And, you know, from that, we're looking at ways that we can also count deer, for example, in the landscape. The traditional way of counting deer, very effective ways to be using helicopters. And that still remains a very good way of doing it. But with the focus on carbon and carbon footprints and things like that, you know, we're trying to find ways of moving away from using helicopters to using, for example, drones or using satellite imagery. So that's all work in progress at the moment, but it's certainly developing fast. And I think, you know, for me, the key to deer management is about information. It's about having really good information, putting that on the table to make really good informed management decisions. And so the way that we collect information is really important as well. So, you know, I've got a number of stalkers who are out on the ground using apps, for example, to collect information on habitat, on where they're shooting deer and how they're counting deer, and using technology in that way. So to me, information is power. The more information we can collect and gather, and if we can make that really effective and efficient, then we're bringing that to the table. I think, again, that's going to really help us manage the landscape in a much more effective way. So there's so many different areas where technology is coming, and I think it is really exciting.
Another thing that I saw recently was with drones with thermals as well. Mm. So maybe, you know, going forward, is that we obviously know with helicopter counts quite accurately how many deer there are out on the hills. But within the woodland, as we've said, it's extremely hard to know how many deer are in these woodlands. So getting thermals and kind of flying drones over these woodlands and lowland areas, we'll be able to get a more accurate kind of picture of how many deer are actually in this woodlands and a more accurate picture of how many deer are actually in Scotland. So, yeah, it'll be interesting over the next couple of years. It'll be, yeah, how this develops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about venison? You hear it, your people say it's the greenest meat. It's a carbon negative meat because there more role for, can we eat our way out of this problem? Is there more role for venison, or will it create a kind of paradox that we end up with more deer because there's now a big venison market, so we end up with people managing for bigger good numbers?
I think this week we'd have a whole podcast solely dedicated to venison. So this is something that I'm really, really passionate about, this subject, because I think it's so important from two perspectives. One is, we were talking previously about, you know, engaging the public and how we engage public and what we're doing in the uplands. And I think I heard the statistic that we've got something like 83% of our Scottish population is classified as an urban population. And I think what we need to think about is how we connect with largely an urban population with the environment, connect people back to nature. I think we've really lost that. And venison is an amazing way to do that. And I've recently carried out a community venison project with one of the land management groups I work with, deer management groups I work with. And, you know, through that process, through the sort of topic of venison, we've been able to engage the community at all different levels, right from nursery school pupils all the way through to just ordinary members of the community who might be interested in venison and cooking with it, and but don't really know how to get a hold of it or what to do with it. So I think it allows a local community to engage with estates, with their rural environment around them. It allows us to engage with, really importantly, young people, and getting young people engaged, understanding where their food comes from, understanding nature, connecting with the environment. But also, what we find, it's a really good opportunity to help young people understand that the rural environment is somewhere that could offer them a job. That, you know, whether it's in actual deer management or ecology or biology or working as a ranger or in the tourism sector, you know, it's helping young people understand and make those connections. And then also thinking about the health benefits of venison. You know, we should be getting venison out into schools. We should be getting young people cooking with venison, developing the skills to cook from scratch. You know, we had the whole class of S2 pupils from Glenarkin High School. We had them out on an estate, understanding deer, and camera stalking. We were breaking down a whole carcass in the larder, and then they had to go back into the classroom, and they had to present to a Dragon's Den panel a marketing proposal for a burger that they had cooked from scratch. And it was absolutely mind-blowing how much these young people had taken on board, how much they'd learned, and they took great pride in cooking these venison burgers. They were amazing. So we've got so many opportunities to engage through venison and understanding where food comes from. So that's really important. The second part is that if we're going to be shooting more deer, certainly in the longer term, in the shorter term rather, I think Nature Scott have said something like we've got another 50,000 carcasses that could be coming into the food chain. We're going to have to find ways of helping the public and providing that venison into the food chain for the public to get their hands on. So it's about creating that demand for venison, because what we can't have happen is, you know, we can't be leaving deer, multiple deer carcasses on the hill because there simply isn't an outlet for them. It's an amazing product. We should be doing more with it. It should be on everybody's menu just as a routine meat, not even as a luxury product. So I think there's tons of work to do, and I could talk for hours on this, but I think venison is absolutely the key here. Someone said it's venison diplomacy in terms of deer management. So watch this space. There's a lot of work to do.
Mm. This is making me hungry. I think I'm going to have to move on from venison. Started to think about my lunch. This is sadly not venison. We've really, venison leads on to, you know, we're the top predator in the landscape at the moment. And is that right? Is there ever going to be a place for sharing our management of deer with other species like lynx or wolves? Is it suitable or either morally suitable or practical for us to be the species that's managing these? You know, could there be a role for other big animals? I realise this is a question. All our listeners are going to immediately have a view on this question, and it's one that we have to approach with caution. But they're beautiful animals. You know, it'd be lovely to have more beautiful animals in the countryside. But I know it's very complicated.
Yeah, it's a real challenging question, isn't it? I think if we're talking about true ecosystem function, a truly functioning ecosystem's got all the different elements in it, doesn't it? It has these top predators all the way through to the microbiology of the soil and everything in between. And obviously over the years we've removed these top predators. Essentially we are the top predator now. And so I think, you know, it is a very challenging discussion. I think in terms of lynx, which you mentioned, we are starting to have some of those discussions. The key thing is understanding is do we have the different elements in place to allow and welcome these animals into our environment again, essentially, been missing for so long. And whilst we might have the environmental landscape to allow, so for example, lynx, I think there's been areas identified where lynx populations could possibly be viable. We've also got to think about the social landscape and the cultural landscape that would allow those species to thrive and be accepted. And I think that's where the real challenge is, you know, we've moved on so far in society from having these predators, which will come into conflict with people potentially in one way or another. And I don't think that we can ever deny that. It's like how we would manage that conflict. And also, I think we've got to ask, you're right, there is a moral question about introducing those animals into this landscape and whether or not it's the right thing to do for those animals. So I'm excited to hear the discussions developing about lynx, because I think that's possibly something that we could explore further. In terms of wolves, you know, I think that's possibly somewhere down the line. It's not to rule the discussion out. We should never rule discussion out. But it's about creating a healthy discussion around some of these topics, because as with deer, the conversation very, very quickly becomes polarized, you know, and all of that is not helped necessarily by social media, and it's certainly not helped by the media, who love to sensationalize these things. So very quickly we get to seeing these extremes of the argument, and people either love it or hate it. And so it doesn't create that space that we need in the middle to have just a very grown-up conversation about it, and a very rational conversation about it. And that's the area I would like to see us being able to engage more in, is just having this sort of safe space to have some of these discussions, and see where it might lead us. I don't know what other people's views on this are.
I think by introduction of an apex predator, the one thing that I think we need to think about as well is the change to localized ecosystems. So a great example of that is when they reintroduced wolves to Yellowstone and how that changed the landscape again. So we're already trying to change the landscape, and then for it to be changed again might have some negative impacts as well as positive impacts that maybe need to be thought about. From this is coming from a forestry and, you know, a regeneration view.
Going back to what Rachel was saying about having to understand what the nature is doing before you start designing the landscape, it multiplies that, doesn't it? If you've got the more complex your nature, the more humble and understanding and complex the human society needs to be in living alongside it. And I think we're learning that with beaver. People again have strong views, but they're here. And they're not doing what we tell them to. They're not staying where we put them. They're not following our forest plans. They're doing all sorts of things. And some of those things might be good things, but it's not what we intended, or it's not what we managed. So I feel like we are on a rapid and difficult learning journey of working together and working with nature.
I think it also with all of these projects as well is community engagement from the sector. From get-go, I think if you have the community engaged from the start, even with some of these rewilding and natural regeneration forest projects, having them involved so they understand what's going on in their local landscape, you know, that really does have a massive benefit.
Yes, they're not empty landscapes. They've already got, as we've discussed, all sorts of people living and working and doing things in them.
Also, people that have moved to the area, you know, that they don't already understand the local landscape. They will see it as, you know, great example is when people look at the uplands of in the highlands and think, oh, isn't it fantastic? And this is how it's been for thousands, if not, you know, millions of years. But actually, some of these areas would have been forested originally. And you're trying to put native trees back on there, or even allowing natural regeneration to come about. And you get a little bit of kickback from that. From people that have moved to the area.
Yeah, every generation has to learn that afresh, don't they? Because you grow up thinking that your landscape is fixed and then you discover it's changing, and that's quite a hard thing to get your head around for any of us. And so I'd like to hear all your views on this sort of final question, kind of double question, is does anything need to change, or are we kind of going in the right direction with deer management, or what are the key things that might need to change, and what can people listening to this podcast, who maybe are especially if they're a bit new to this, if they're a bit outside the rural economy and getting interested in nature restoration, what could they be doing to help to push things in the right direction, and how could they become part of it? What would your top recommendations be?
Oh, that's difficult questions, aren't they? I think in terms of deer management more widely, what would I like to change? I think part of it is changing the narrative that we have around deer. I'm quite keen to see that, because I mentioned before, I think we've allowed deer management to become very heavily politicized, and we've allowed it to become quite polarized in our views, and people pitting each other, pitting views against each other. And I say it's all played out in the media and social media, and that's not helpful. You know, I think we've got much more to gain if we work together for common good, for common benefit, there's a project currently underway in deer management where we're trying to look at that, bring all the different stakeholders around the table and see where there are areas that we can work together. Where are these areas of common ground? And let's focus on that rather than always sort of feeling like we're at loggerheads. So I'd like to see the narrative changing around deer. I think we've also got to think about the other herbivores that are in the landscape. You know, we talk about deer, but we rarely mention the number of sheep that we have in the landscape. They're also a herbivore. They're also having an impact on the landscape. And I think we've got to bring that into the mix, particularly when we're thinking about how we might be looking forward and looking at subsidies and incentives for land management. We've got to bring all the different elements into that discussion. But I think we've also got to really engage with young people, engage with communities. I've said it before, it's so vital. We've got to help young people coming into the deer management sector. In my experience more recently, you know, I've seen young people coming in, they're really enthusiastic, they're motivated, they're passionate about what they do. And to some extent, they have a greater perhaps understanding of some of the nuance about environmental issues, about biodiversity and all of these things. And I think we're seeing this new generation of deer managers and potentially owners coming into the mix who are much more kind of environmentally aware. And I think it's about helping particularly these young people navigate what all the challenges that might be ahead with this. So ensuring that they've got the right skills, we can help with that. We can make sure we've got the right technology, but also bringing in all the skills and knowledge and the traditional side of things. So yeah, there's a change in itself, as I say, is it brings about uncertainty and fear, but I just keep coming back to this idea that we've got to identify the opportunities in here and change the narrative and see it as opportunity. And that's a real opportunity to engage with the wider public, you know, take the time to help people connect with nature, to understand what's going on in the much wider world around them. And I think everybody should be doing that. And that's something that I'm trying to encourage as many people that I work with to do on an everyday basis.
I definitely don't have the 40 years experience that other people have, but over the years, when I've grown up, we've always had deer seasons. So you've had the stag stocking up the rut until October, and then the hind season coming in. And the Scottish Government have recently announced that there is no longer going to be, from the 21st of October, a stag season. So will that change how people are managing their deer? Will they continue to shoot after the rut and kind of amalgamate both hind and stag shooting together? That sort of thing could change quite a lot. And also, as Lindsay is saying, it's kind of the changes that are coming about, that we have our traditional kind of stocking estates, and then you've got a mixture of livestock, hill ground farms, and then we've got kind of environmentally focused people coming in as well. So it's in managing the changes that are coming with all of these stakeholders within the land. And yeah, it's a very, very difficult to keep everyone happy within that.
The trajectory we are going, after listening to Lindsay and obviously Rachel, yourself, Eleanor, I think we are going in the right direction. And I think with getting schools and educating the younger generations in on stalking and also the wider environmental impacts of deer and rewilding and so on, and of other herbivores, is just all going to just benefit us moving forward. I think that, yeah, like you say, that the environmental benefits are becoming more and more popular with people wanting to come out into the countryside and up on the hills. But yeah, we can't lose where we have came from. It's same in like forestry and old practices and stuff like that, but we can't lose that kind of history behind all of the industry, every sector that is involved in this. So
just before we wrap up here, guys, I do have one little kind of fun question, I suppose, that we could I want you to just quickly answer if you want. We'll start with yourself, Lindsay. You talked obviously quite passionately about venison and quite in depth, but do you enjoy eating venison?
Oh, I'd say I could talk a whole podcast about this. We generally have about 2 chest freezers full of venison at any one time here. So I've had to become quite inventful with recipes and things. But I really enjoy it. And, you know, I love introducing friends and family to venison. And and just getting people interested in it and exploring new ways that we can cook with it. So I could go on for another hour on this, but I'll leave it at that.
No worries. And anyone else? Well, partial to venison.
I have to say I love it. I've grown up with venison stew most Sundays or venison roast most Sundays, so it's definitely a common thing in the household is a roast with venison.
Yeah, and again, we've got a chest freezer that's probably full of a 3/4 full of venison as well, and we mince it a lot of it, so it's great to get it into for the children to spaghetti bolognese's.
Oh, I'm really envious because I love venison, and for me it's a rare treat. It's not so available here in the middle of Edinburgh, but lovely rare venison steak or casserole or something. It's a great treat. So. I need to come visit you all more often.
Like I said, that's just all about we've got time for in today's show. Firstly, my thanks to our guests, of course, Alex and Rachel from our team, from our forestry team in Inverness. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And of course, Lindsay Sivright. Lindsay, thank you very much for coming on as well. If listeners do have any queries or questions for you, how should they get in touch with you?
Just look up my website. If you Google, find my website, and please drop me a line. I'd be happy to have a chat with anybody who wants to. And thanks for inviting me. It's been
excellent. And of course, Eleanor, we'll be back with another podcast soon.
Yes, I hope so. Always great fun. I always learn things.
Yeah, looking forward to it. If you're new to Galbraith, make sure to subscribe to our podcasts on Apple and Spotify so you never miss an episode. We've also got a number of Talking Natural Capital podcasts already published in the last year, so you can go back and listen to them. They're not time sensitive really as well, but you can feel free to listen at your own leisure. And as I said, we'll be back as well with other business stream podcasts in the future. Make sure to follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, X as it's now known, Instagram, LinkedIn and TikTok, and that's all at Galbraith Group. My thanks again to Eleanor, Alex, Rachel and Lindsay for joining me on today's podcast, and to you, the listener, for your continued support. I've been Matt Finlay, and this has been Galbraith Podcasts.